rolls with playful sarcasm, and I smile. I deserved that. She laughs politely. I'm glad to hear it, though. You're much too young to be living that way, right? You should be out and having fun. Rachel bumbles over her words and pecks at her cardboard coffee cup. She is much more nervous here in my home than she was at my old house. My not saying anything after her awkward bromide about the exciting life a young, single woman should be living in the big city likely isn't helping her feel at ease, so I say, I could just sit and marinate in this coffee. You're my hero this morning. I'm glad you approve. I just love the hint of nutmeg on a cold morning like this. We hum approvingly as we both take a sip. Rachel switches subjects. Your high ceilings are dreamy. I love your green kitchen and the yellow in the living room. Unexpected color scheme, but it flows well, especially with the open floor plan. Thank you. Each room is a different color. I plan on changing their colors once a year, every February, I think. February is such a dreary month otherwise, particularly in Boston. How many more rooms are there? Two. My blue bedroom and my red media room.
Media room?
It's the condo's second bedroom that I use as my play area. It's where I keep my TV, tablet docking station, bookcases, movies, video games, all the fun stuff. She nods, sips her coffee, then says, Shall we get started?
We shall.
Rachel takes out her phone and turns on her recording app. She places the phone down between us on the counter. There's an almost reverent moment of silence, as though we're both acknowledging the power the device has over our conversation and over us. I want to focus on the television show today. Focus on what it was like living with the cameras and the production crew. That had to be a strange experience for a child.
It was. But I think any and all experiences are strange for a child.
It had to be especially strange for you.
I guess. I'm not trying to be a smartass, but that's hard for me to say. I haven't lived anyone else's normal experience to compare mine to.
I have talked to some of the show's producers and former employees of the production company, but I'm still unclear as to how the show came about.
So am I. I laugh at my own joke.
Let's piece it together, then. According to the timeline I have, the show started filming less than a month after the night you found Marjorie in your parents' room. Can you tell me what happened at home in those weeks in between?
Not a lot. I remember Marjorie going away to the hospital for about 2 weeks so she could get some rest. That was how Mom put it. It may sound strange, but my world was a scary place, or scarier place for me with Marjorie gone. In hindsight, it's likely that Mom was suffering from depression. She started smoking in the house instead of going outside. She was drinking a lot, wine mostly, and cried to herself in the kitchen. I remember her sitting there in all that smoke, alternately holding her head up high, defiantly blowing out her smoke, and then crumbling down into herself. I was too afraid to talk to her, to try to comfort her, and she couldn't even look at me if I went into the kitchen to get a drink or a snack. I don't remember Dad being around much while Marjorie was gone, but when he was, he argued with Mom about how long Marjorie would be in the hospital, how they'd pay for any of it, but mostly they argued about letting Father Wanderley try to help them.
Did they ever talk about remanding Marjorie to the state? Were they worried that the state would step in?
I don't remember them talking about that, no. I could be wrong, but I think for the most part, Marjorie behaved like a normal, surly teen for her psychiatrist and hospital staff. At least that's what Marjorie told me when I asked her what going to the psychiatrist was like. Anyway, I couldn't take my parents' arguments anymore and stopped spying on them. After a couple of days without Marjorie, I tried to stay away from my parents altogether. Dad kept trying to bless me and make me pray with him. I ran and hid whenever I felt his big paw landing on my head. When Marjorie finally came back home, it was my turn to leave. They shipped me away to stay with Dad's sister, my Auntie Erin. I stayed with her for a week, maybe more. I did homework, played with her dog Nico, and cried myself to sleep. Erin brought me to school and took me trick-or-treating on Halloween. I went as a zombie soccer player. Because I was so clever, I shouted, "Goal," instead of moaning for brains. I remember telling Erin that the candy in her neighborhood was better than mine, but I was just saying it to make her feel good. The very day Mom brought me back home, Marjorie was upstairs in her room, and Father Wanderley and another priest, a younger guy, Father Gavin, were sitting in the living room. Father Wanderley gave me a crooked smile and the weakest handshake ever. It was like shaking hands with a bird. Father Gavin just waved hi at me, shy, like the boys at school who were afraid of catching cooties from a girl. He was short and pudgy and had too much hair on the back of his neck. Then I remember being rushed into the kitchen and my parents sat me down and told me about how we were going to do a TV show. Dad was excited, manic even, pacing around the room, punctuating his sentences with hallelujahs. Mom tried to be reassuring, but she still couldn't look at me. That was it? It all happened that fast? I was only a kid, and they didn't tell me much of the nitty-gritty details. I'm sure there are gaps in what I'm not remembering as well. What I remember them telling me was that someone was going to make a TV show about us, that these same people were going to help Marjorie get better and help us too. Dad said that the TV show was going to be our family's new job, and that we would be paid well for doing our job. Mom said that cameras would be in all the rooms, some people might follow me around and ask questions, and that if I ever got scared by one of them, to tell her right away. From what little I know, and from what you've told me so far, I'm surprised your mom wasn't more resistant to the idea of doing the television show. Oh, I think she was very resistant, which is obvious when you watch the show and her interviews, right? As to when or how the final decision to sign the dotted line was made, I have no idea. I was out of that house for more than a week. Maybe Dad wore her down, bullied her into signing the contract. She clearly wasn't as outwardly fervent as Dad with the new old-time religion, but maybe she saw the light. Even knowing better, maybe despite her protests, deep down, she believed it would help Marjorie, and she was ashamed by that belief. Maybe it was cold and simple pragmatism. Money. We were going broke, and the producers swooped in and made her an offer she couldn't refuse, right? I don't know. Your guess about why Mom went along with it all is as good as mine. I sincerely doubt that, Mary. I smile. It's the first time Rachel has pushed back and accused me of not being forthcoming. Good for her. I was 8 and she was my mom. Her motivations were beyond me and continued to be. I will say that she never explicitly told me the show would transform us into the town freaks, the laughingstocks of the neighborhood, but only because she never had to say it. It was there, between her lines and in everything she did once the cameras were in our house. Rachel asks more questions from there, and I answer them, or I answer most of them anyway. Her questions are now about show particulars she probably could have just found out herself. Or maybe she already knows the answers and is testing to see how honest I'm being with her. I say, "Yes, the lag time between filming and the episode airing was about 2 weeks. Rachel, let's stretch our legs and finish the tour of the condo. We could go to the roof deck, too, if you'd like." "May I keep taping our conversation?" "Certainly." We walk through the kitchen, back into the living room, then curl right into the first bedroom, which is shaped like a long rectangle, a print of Andrew Wyeth's Christina's World, and a small collection of watercolor landscapes and shorelines from local artists dot the walls. My queen-sized bed has a shiny brass frame and is covered with a fluffy white duvet. The bed is underneath a window that overlooks the ocean. The room is quiet and plain, and the walls are a bright sky blue. She says, "That is a spectacular view. Your bedroom is quite lovely. I wish my silly daughter would keep her apartment so tidy and adult-looking. I was going to say subdued, but you're more to the point." Rachel walks into the middle of the room, gingerly touches the antique dresser, and does a full turn, spinning like the world's slowest ballerina. "Is this room the same color as your childhood bedroom?" I resist the urge to say something that would have been totally Marjorie. Maybe the room was a disastrous and dark blue, the color of a painful bruise, only yesterday. I say, I don't know if it's the exact shade or hue, but yes, it's the same. It helps me dream in sky blue.
May I quote you directly on that?
Of course. I assumed you'd be using many direct quotes. You're not writing fiction with this book, correct? We both laugh. I'm nervous, almost dizzy, as I walk out of the bedroom, and Rachel silently follows me out and next door to the second bedroom, my media room. Rachel says, "Now this looks like my daughter's apartment. No offense." I say, "You're terrible," and gently swipe her shoulder. "So this is my playroom. What kind of playroom would it be if it wasn't in a state of beautiful chaos?" The left wall is covered by 5 black bookcases, each over 6 feet tall, and the shelves full of books, comics, and movies. On the wall across from the door is the room's only window. No ocean view here, but the brick facade of the neighboring brownstone. On our right is a desk overflowing with more totems of pop culture. Beneath the rubble, somewhere, is my tablet docking station. Next to the desk is a wall-mounted flat screen. In the middle of the room, a lost island in a violent sea, is my lumpy futon couch.
You weren't kidding when you said the room was red.
Yeah, it's redder than I thought it was going to be. It looked different on the paint chip. If there was more natural lighting in the room, it would be a softer red, I think.
I must say, it warms my writer's heart to see so many hard copies of books filling your shelves.
I have digital copies of just about everything you see, but I like having the physical artifacts as well. I used to collect vinyl records, too, but that became too unwieldy and expensive.
Rachel walks to the bookcases, surveys the spines of books and DVDs. She stops at the 4th of the 5 cases and says my name like a question. Mary?
I walk around the futon toward the case and say, "Ah, my horror section."
I am not familiar with all the titles, but I'd say it's more than a horror section and that it has a particular focus.
Rachel says it like she's angry and disappointed. I can imagine the conversations she has when visiting her daughter's messy apartment. I'm sad for the both of them. And I'm insanely jealous. Well, the possession and exorcism stuff is only a subsection of my horror section.
For the benefit of my recorder, would you mind reading me the titles in this subsection?
Be happy to. In no particular order, I've tried to alphabetize on numerous occasions, but I always seem to lose steam. Anyway, in movies, The Exorcist and its 4 sequels and prequels, The Exorcism of Emily Rose, The Last Exorcism, The Devil Inside Me, The Conjuring, Constantine, The Rite, Wreck 2, The Amityville Horror, both versions, Paranormal Activity and its sequels, Evil Dead 1 and 2, Exorcismo. I quickly explain how other titles like Session 9, The Legend of Hell House, Burnt Offerings, and The Shining fit into this subsection as well. For novels, I point out other notable titles besides the obvious one written by William Peter Blatty. Those titles include Come Closer by Sarah Gran, Pandemonium by Daryl Gregory, Rosemary's Baby by Ira Levin. For nonfiction, I point out The Exorcist, Studies in the Horror Film, American Exorcism, Expelling Demons in the Land of Plenty, God is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything, and even the laughably bad Pigs in the Parlor, The Practical Guide to Deliverance. When I'm done reading titles, Rachel asks, "Forgive the potentially obvious question, but have you actually seen all these movies and read all these books?" "Yes. Well, yes, for this section anyway. I can't say I've read or seen everything in every bookcase."
"I have to admit, Mary, I find it shocking that you would collect all these..."
Rachel pauses to wave her hand at the bookcase.
"Titles."
"Shocking? Really? I don't know, you could say that I have a personal interest in the subject matter."
I laugh, then walk over to my desk and sit in the little black chair.
shocking is an extreme word, but it fits, that you would willingly or obsessively choose to relive over and over again the horror of what you went through as a child is shocking to me. I'm not reliving anything. None of these books or movies come close to being like what I lived through. Are you searching to find answers to what happened to you and your family? I don't know if I'd put it that way exactly, but yeah, I'm always looking for answers in everything I do. Aren't you? Isn't that why you want to write a book about me? That's a good question, Mary. I'm interested in finding the story, an accurate account of what happened. Ah, those can be two different things. Rachel smiles, though she is still clearly unnerved by the bookcase discovery. Very true. Now, Mary, I know this process can be difficult and will continue to become more so. You have to trust that I am not trying to belittle in any way the nightmarish, traumatic experience you suffered through, okay? And that I will treat it with respect. It's a testament to your character that you've become the responsible and well-adjusted adult that you are. You're too kind. My years and years of therapy have helped. And I do trust you. I do. I wouldn't have let you in otherwise. Rachel carefully considers the bookcases again. Let me ask you this. Does watching the movies make you feel, I don't know, empowered or comforted in a weird way? In what weird way? It's empowering that you're able to overcome the images on the screen, which are more over-the-top and overtly supernatural than what you actually experienced. What does that say about you or anyone else that my sister's nationally televised psychotic break and descent into schizophrenia wasn't horrific enough? That's not what I meant, Mary. I open my mouth to say something, but she holds up a stop hand and keeps talking. And it's not your fault. I'm badly stumbling around the point here. She pauses, then adds, Okay, Mary, why did you show me your media room? You had to know that on some level I'd be surprised by what I saw. Just sharing? I say it like a question and shrug. We share a smile and a weighty silence. Okay. I'll admit what you were saying about the books and movies being a comfort. There's some truth there. But it's not about overcoming anything. It's about making what happened to me seem more explicable when compared to the lurid ridiculousness of those stories. Are you worried you'll conflate what happened with the fictions you watch and read? You said to me on our first day together that your memories were mixed together with what other people told you about what had happened, and you'd included pop culture and media. I said that? I say, and spin around one full revolution in my desk chair. Not in those exact words, but essentially, yes. Sounds like me, I say. I'm kidding. I remember telling you that, but I'd meant only the pop cultural, internet, and media treatment of the reality show and of what had happened to me and my family, not the Hollywood movies and books. Let me put it this way. Me and my story might have some fuzzy, blurry parts. But I know my sister wasn't Regan. You don't believe your sister was possessed, do you? By a supernatural entity? No, I don't. Did you believe it when you were 8 years old? The 8-year-old me still believed in Bigfoot. But with Marjorie, I honestly wasn't sure what to believe. I don't think I knew what I wanted to believe, other than I wanted to believe in her. I always did. Rachel nods and then slowly turns away from me and back to the bookcases. I wonder how many of the books she's read, which of the movies she's seen. Her fingers drift over the spines. I think there was too much sugar in my coffee. Or not enough, as I still feel a little lightheaded. I stand and say, Rachel, did I tell you that I just landed my first paying writing gig? No. I had no idea you were a writer. That's fantastic, Mary. Thank you. I'm very excited. It's my first paying job that isn't bartending or waitressing. It isn't much, but it's nice to be no longer solely subsisting on residuals from the show, the family trust fund, and, of course, what your publisher is paying me. What's the gig? I've been writing a horror blog for a few years now, a quite popular one, if I do say so myself, and it was just picked up by the horror zine Fangoria. They'll feature my blog online, and I'll write an assignment column for each issue. I'm impressed, and I'm very happy for you, Mary. Can I read the blog? Please do. It's called The Last Final Girl. I write it under a pseudonym, Karen Brissett. Why that name? Totally random. Really. Anyway, Fangoria has no idea I am who I really am, so they're paying me for my writing merits only. That's important to me. I feel, I don't know, validated. Does that make sense? Yes. Yes, it does. You continue to impress me, Mary. Aw, shucks. I walk toward the door. Okay, time for the tour to move again. Would you like to see the roof deck? No, thank you. I'm not a huge fan of heights, or exposed heights. I know, I'm a mess. Not at all. Let's go back to the kitchen, then. Can I get you a drink of water or anything else? Water would be great. And can we get back to talking about what your life was like when they were filming the show? We can. We walk back to the kitchen, and we're back at the counter with our glasses of water. She says, I'd like to ask you about the basement reenactment from the show. It's quite a harrowing scene, with Marjorie eating the dirt and following you up the stairs. Yeah, it is. I have to admit, much to my shame, that I exaggerated what happened. Or maybe embellished is a better word. I laugh. It was the first time my parents let me be interviewed in detail by one of the two writers for the show, Ken Fletcher. Ken was such a nice guy. He would play with me downstairs in the living room when there was nothing going on. And there was a lot of nothing going on, at least early on. Anyway, I didn't want to disappoint him, and I remember how Dad had told me that the new family job was the TV show, so I wanted to do everything I could to help. Okay, let's start with what really happened in the basement, then. Chapter 16. On the first day, the crew kicked us out of the house. It was early, so early it was still dark out when Mom shook me awake. Dad and Marjorie left before us, but I don't remember where they went. We didn't see them again until we came home the next morning. When Mom and I walked out the front door, there were already three white vans parked out front and all sorts of people on the lawn. Some of them had clipboards and milled around the yard, looking into the windows and taking measurements. Others carried thick black cases and lighting equipment into the house, or they brought in electrical cords that had been coiled into tight circles. There was a subgroup of people who weren't carrying anything, and they appeared to be a regular family. They clustered on the lawn, looking up at the house and smiling like they'd just moved in. There was a mom and dad and two sisters. Their clothes were new, unwrinkled, and brightly colored. I waved at the little girl, who kind of looked like me, though she was taller. She waved back, but then quickly hid behind the older sister, who wore a lot of makeup. The older sister, like the parents, was listening to one of the clipboard-carrying people. The woman with the clipboard gestured at the house while she talked. The family laughed, and I didn't like that they were laughing at our house. Once we were in the car, Mom explained that they would be filming what were called reenactment scenes, and that the other family was a group of actors who were pretending to be us. She kept stopping to ask me if I understood what she said and what was going on. I lied and told her I did. She also told me the actors would only be at our house for one day and night, and that we would be the show after the actors left. We spent the day and night at Auntie Erin's house. I remember eating too many hot dogs and watching the movie Monsters, Inc. by myself twice and falling asleep on the couch. On the second day, the crew transformed our house. Marjorie was in her room, sequestered away like the secret everyone already knew. Mom was in there with her. I hid under the dining room table. We had cleared the table of the folded stacks of clothes a few days before. It had taken me forever to clean my room and put all those stupid clothes away. I'd let everyone in the house know how terrible and unfair that chore was. My parents had then covered the table with a white tablecloth that we had only ever used for holiday dinners. All the prep work had seemed needless to me, especially given my parents' explicit instructions that we were not to act or do anything differently for the cameras. With the TV people now roaming the house, I pretended the dining room table wasn't the real one, but was a ghost table in its white sheet. The crew wouldn't be able to see me under it, which may or may not have been true. But from my ghostly vantage, I couldn't see how many people were coming in and out of the house. And I couldn't see who was barking orders, who was laughing that well-deep laugh, and who was banging and drilling the walls and ceilings. So I left the safety of the ghost table and wandered. Dad was in the kitchen, sitting at the table and talking with two men. I'd later find out that the younger one with the black curly hair was Barry Cotton. He was the show's producer/director. He was nice enough to me, one-on-one, but I didn't like how he would talk to me like a baby whenever the rest of my family was around. The other man at the kitchen table was Ken Fletcher, the show's main writer. He had freckles, thick beard stubble, and a bright smile. Ken would quickly become my friend. Crew members mounted small, cyclopic cameras on the dining room, living room, and kitchen ceilings. Horrified that they could be doing the same in my room, I ran upstairs to put a stop to it. There were crew members in the hallway, and they mounted more ceiling cameras. They all said hi to me, with one saying, "Hey there, little lady," as I ignored them and dodged their stepladders. My room's door was still closed. I ran inside, and there weren't any crew or cameras, but my cardboard house with its magic marker vine graffiti was back in its old spot. We'd moved it to the basement a few weeks ago because I'd told my parents I didn't want the house anymore, that it took up too much space. But the truth was that I couldn't sleep with it in the room any longer, that I was too afraid of the growing things on the outside and the darkness the house kept on the inside. I yelled through my closed bedroom door, "No cameras in my room, and no one is allowed to put stuff in my room." I hesitantly walked over and kicked the cardboard house, but I jumped backward immediately, afraid it would retaliate. My goal kick dented one of the corners. I wouldn't be able to drag the house back down to the basement with all those people in the hallway, and I didn't want to stay closed up in my room with a growing things house. My room was too clean to set up any elaborate security devices. So on the way out, I retied my purple robe belt to the corner of the bed and the doorknob. It had never stopped Marjorie from sneaking in, but maybe it would stop the crew. On my way back to the first floor, I stopped and peeked into the sunroom. One guy who smelled like salad dressing and had a tool belt hanging way too low on his skinny hips nailed up a black drop cloth over the bay window. I stood in the doorway, mouth hanging open and fists planted on my sides. I said, "You're changing our house. It's not a sunroom if there isn't any sun." A woman who adjusted two spotlights, one large and one small, laughed and told me not to worry, that it was only temporary and they'd put everything back the way it was when it was all over. I wanted to ask her what she meant by her "when it was all over." I told her that I didn't like it. The yellow wallpaper looked old and faded under the harsh spotlights. Another crew member set up some microphones and a camera on a tripod pointed at the love seat. He wore a black baseball hat that had the show's logo on it. The logo was "The Possession" in white, capital block letters, with "the" resting on top of "possession" so that the letters formed the shape of our house. I went back downstairs, and everyone was so big and loud and busy. I couldn't watch TV, and I didn't think I could go back under the dining room table without being seen. I decided I was thirsty and hungry, but I didn't want to go into the kitchen and be cornered by Dad, because he'd make me talk to the producer some more. He'd fire off questions about soccer, asking what my favorite book or movie or song was, and I'd feel pressure to perform, as though it was up to me to prove to the world that Mom and Dad were not at fault here, and had managed to raise at least one bright, cheery, normal daughter. So I went down into the basement instead. Normally, the basement was too dark and scary for me to even contemplate with its dirt floor, the ceiling of exposed wooden beams, those bones of the first floor from which hung more cobwebs than light bulbs, the growly and hissing furnace, and toward the back of the basement on the left side, the bulkhead staircase, which was the creepiest. A literal hole in the wall, a black mouth cut into the foundation that led up to the creaky, rusty bulkhead that opened to the side yard. But since my parents had become flush with TV money, they had gone on a triumphant shopping spree at Sam's Club, buying bulk quantities of all manner of non-perishable food and drink items. Our fully stocked shelves could sustain us through the show, through the end of the coming winter, and maybe through the apocalypse. Of course, these shelves and their cornucopia were in the basement. I reached inside the door with one arm, groped the wall for the light switch, and found it. Already my basement bravery had leaked away. I left the door open behind me so that the noisy crew could still keep me company. As I tiptoed down, the stairs felt too soft under my shoes. The sounds of the crew didn't follow me down and instead grew distant. I came to the horrifying realization that if something happened to me in the basement, I could yell and scream all I wanted, and no one would hear me in the loud, busy world of upstairs. The air was cool and moist and pressed against me. I felt my way along the foundation wall, and the gray, misshapen stones were gritty to the touch. I hated thinking about these old stones and their crumbling mortar holding up everything. Coming down here by myself had seemed like a much better idea when I was upstairs, but I was too stubborn to leave empty-handed. I quickly scooted past the furnace and hot water heater on my right, washer and dryer and their collection of hoses on my left, past the dark mouth of the bulkhead stairs and to the far foundation wall that held up the back end of the house, and the set of slightly crooked wooden shelves stacked to the ceiling with their cache of goodies, jars, cans, soda and water bottles, and large corrugated cardboard boxes. I wanted to use those boxes when emptied to create a miniature town to replace the white cardboard house in my room. On the second row of shelves, at my eye level, were plastic-wrapped cases of juice boxes and peanut butter crackers. I had to push, lift, and twist other boxes to get to what I wanted. It was like a life-size game of Jenga. I almost lost the game as I pulled one corner of a multi-pack of assorted Cheerios boxes out too far, and everything above it on the shelves shook and settled. I worked a small hole into the plastic wrap, using my teeth like a small, thieving rodent, and eventually pried out two juice boxes and a package of crackers. I tried to force the Cheerios back to its spot by ramming my shoulder into the multi-pack, but it wouldn't budge. I kept pushing and grunting and even talking to it, telling the cereal to get back into its stupid place. "Need some help, monkey?" I screamed, dropped the crackers, and spun around. Marjorie was there, dressed in jeans and a gray sweatshirt. She was barefoot, and her toes wiggled and wormed in the cold dirt. She smiled and shook her head. "Are you really that afraid of me now?" Her hair was tied back, no loose strands. It felt like I hadn't seen her without her face obscured by her hair or her hood in forever. Her eyes were bright and focused, her neck long, chin sharpened to a point. She looked older, a glimpse of the adult Marjorie I would never see. I said, "No." I was relieved to no longer be in the basement by myself, and I was happy to see Marjorie dressed and walking about on her own, without Mom or Dad following her around like a pet that wasn't house-trained. But yes, I was still a little afraid of her. "Good. You shouldn't be." Marjorie walked to the shelves and lifted up the boxes resting against the wedged multipack of Cheerios. "Here, go ahead, push it in." I pushed with all my might, and it slid back into place so easily I lost my balance, stumbled, and bounced my head off the cereal. "Ow!" I giggled nervously and rubbed my forehead. Marjorie walked into the far corner, where there was no dangling light bulb, to where our parents stored holiday decorations, summer clothes, boxes of unlabeled miscellany, and old furniture. She said, "Look at all this junk." I held my ground near the shelves. "Does Mom know you're down here?" Marjorie picked through some of the open packs and boxes. Probably not. She fell asleep in my room. Crazy what's going on upstairs, huh? I imagined Mom face down on Marjorie's bed. Maybe there was something terribly wrong with her. I tried not to panic, or at least not let it show in my voice when I said, "Yeah, I don't like it. I am sorry about that. Most of this is my fault. Did you put my cardboard house back in my room?" "What do you mean? Hasn't it always been in your room?"
"No. Mom helped me move it down here last week."
"Really? How come?"
"I don't know. I was sick of it, I guess."
"Right." Marjorie made a show of looking around the basement. "It's not down here, is it?"
"No. They must have moved it back."
"They?" "The TV people. I like calling them that. The TV people. And they have TVs for heads and their faces can change when the channels change. Creepy, right?"
"I guess. Why would they put the house back in my room?"
Marjorie looked bored but quickly explained that the TV people had been in our house all day and all night yesterday, with actors pretending to be us, and they were filming what they called the reenactment scenes. They'd needed the house back in my room so they could film actor Mary finding the cardboard house covered in growing things. I took it all in, not quite sure how she could know all that, and said,
"So it wasn't you then?"
"Nope, dope. I didn't move your house back to your room, I swear." Marjorie crossed her heart and held up her right hand. I didn't say anything. What she'd said to me about actor Mary made sense, but I wasn't sure if she was telling the full truth. It was possible that Marjorie brought the house up herself, and the TV people were happy to find it there and use it.
"Mary, you have to trust me. I'm still your big sister. I wouldn't steer you wrong, right?"
I looked down and nodded. I picked up my dropped crackers, then pried the plastic straw off the side of one of the juice boxes and stabbed its pointed end through the small tinfoil-covered hole. She said, "I'm going to let you in on a big secret so that you'll trust me again."
"Is it about Mom or Dad?"
"No, it's about me. It's the biggest secret of all, so you can't tell Mom or anyone else, okay?" I wasn't sure if I wanted to hear such a big secret. It might not fit in my head, and then it would spill out everywhere. But at the same time, my skin prickled with wanting to know what it was.
"Okay, tell me."
"I am not possessed by a demon or anything like that." My face must have performed some impressive contortions because Marjorie doubled over laughing. "What, didn't Dad tell you why this is all happening with the show and the priests? Didn't he tell you that they believe Satan or one of his demon peeps lives deep inside me and makes me do terrible, bad girl things?" When she said Satan, she crouched down low, widened her eyes, and spread her arms out wide. It made the word extra scary. I was embarrassed and meekly explained that Mom and Dad hadn't mentioned Satan or any demons to me, and they hadn't told me what exactly was wrong with her, only that everyone was just trying to help her get through a rough time.
"Jesus, that's messed up. And I'm the one they sent away for 2 weeks."
Marjorie crossed her arms and walked in a tight circle, as though deciding which one of a million possible directions to go in. "Actually, I am possessed, only I'm possessed by something so much older and cooler than Satan." I stood still and stared at her. When she said, "I am possessed," I pictured a giant green hand closing over her, hiding her from me forever. "Ideas. I'm possessed by ideas. Ideas that are as old as humanity. Maybe older, right? Maybe those ideas were out there just floating around before us, just waiting to be thought up. Maybe we don't think them. We pluck them out from another dimension or another mind." Marjorie seemed so pleased with herself, and I wondered if this was something new she'd just thought up or something she'd told someone before. I asked,
Is that what the voices in your head tell you?
Hey, how do you know about the voices?
You've talked about the voices before, waking up at night and at the kitchen table.
Oh, right. I guess I have. Hard to keep track of everything, you know.
The voices, yeah. I don't know.
Marjorie's bright, triumphant tone faded.
I think I'm just imagining them, you know?
She paused, wrapped her arms around her chest, and hesitantly started talking again.
They're not there most of the time, but if I start thinking about them or obsessing about them, they happen, almost like I make them happen. Like I'm inside my own head, only I don't know it's me in there. So I'm trying not to think about them. And now when the voices come back, I listen to my iPod on level a billion and drown them out. Seems to work. I can handle them now. No biggie.
Okay. Hey, look, Mary. Marjorie let her arms fall down to her sides, laughed, and shook her head.
Don't you worry about me. I know I've done some weird shit while I've been figuring things out, and the voices are real, but the truth is I'm fine. And I've been pretending. I've been faking it.
Faking what?
Faking that I've been possessed by something that's making me do terrible things.
Why?
What do you mean, why? Isn't it obvious yet?
Marjorie looked around the basement and at me like she was genuinely confused, like she didn't know where she was.
Mom and Dad were totally stressed about money and the house. I hated being in stupid high school, and then I started hearing the voices. Stress-induced, probably, yeah, but still, it sort of freaked me out. Then I got super pissed when they started sending me to Dr. Hamilton and his fastest prescription pad in the East, when they were the ones who should have been getting help, not me. They're a mess. You've had to notice that they're a total mess, right? And then Dad added to the mess with his new Finding God BS, so I decided I'd just keep pushing it, see how far I could go. And I was going to leave you out of it, but I got mad at you for telling Mom about my stories, and by the time that super creepy Father Wanderly got involved, it was easy to keep pushing, keep pretending, keep it all going. And now I don't have to take Dr. Hamilton's pills anymore, and we have the show, right? You guys should be thanking me. I saved the house. I saved us, all of us. And I'm going to make us famous. Even as an earnest and gullible 8-year-old, and without the gifts and hindrances of hindsight, I saw the gaping holes in her story, and I knew that Marjorie didn't really believe in what she was saying. She was trying to convince herself that she was okay and in control of what was happening to her and to us. In that moment, I was afraid for her instead of being afraid of her. And I wanted to help the house and family, too. I asked, "So, wait, where do your ideas really come from?"
"Everywhere. The internet, mostly." Marjorie laughed with a hand over her mouth.
"You mean the song and the molasses story? Internet,
internet.
The growing things?
That one's mine. That one is real." "You still can't ever forget that story, Miss Mary." "Hey, isn't this basement just like the basement in the growing things story? Remember the part where you were in the basement and the growing things came out and up from the dirt, Mom's poisoned and buried body dangling off the vines? So creepy, right? You can almost see it happening right now. You can almost feel the growing things warming up between our toes." Marjorie bent down and tickled my ankles.
"Stop it!"
I slapped her hands away.
"Ow! Mary's slaps are the worst. I have no idea how someone so little can hit so hard."
I laughed, then bared my teeth and raised my free hand, threatening her with more Mary slaps. Marjorie mock screamed, and I chased her around the basement. I whiffed on trying to slap her butt as she ran by and dashed into and up the bulkhead stairwell. Then the lights went out. I gasped, losing all my air. Marjorie screamed, but then started laughing. She said,
"Come sit with me in here, Mary. I'll hold your hand."
I stood in the middle of the basement. It was dark, but not pitch black as rectangles of weak light filtered down from the two basement windows. Still, I could see only shadows and outlines, and I couldn't see Marjorie. I said,
"What did you do? Turn the lights back on."
"That wasn't me. Why do you always blame me for everything? Stay where you are, monkey. I'll come to you." I heard her bare feet slowly sliding and shuffling on the cement bulkhead stairs, and it sounded like she had many more than 2 feet. Was she walking on all fours down the stairs because it was too dark to see? I didn't want to wait for her or stay where I was. I wanted to sprint back up to the first floor and leave her down here, let her wait, watch, and see if any growing things would finally sprout from the dirt floor. It was her idea anyway.
"Is someone down there?"
Dad's voice echoed, followed shortly by heavy pounding on the basement stairs. He and a crew member I didn't know were at the bottom of the stairs and turned the corner before I could announce myself. The crewman had a flashlight.
"Mary, what the hell are you doing? You didn't mess around with the breakers, did you?"
"What? Dad, no, I just came down to get a snack."
I held up my spent juice box and unopened pack of crackers, and I also looked to the foundation wall on my right and the bulkhead stairs. Marjorie hadn't come out yet, nor had she announced herself. He said,
"Did Mom say you could do that? I guess that's fine, right?"
I wasn't sure if he was asking me if this was fine or the crewman or if he knew Marjorie was down here and was trying to trick her out. Either way, Dad didn't wait for an answer. He walked past me toward the circuit breaker panel that was on the wall between the bulkhead stairs and the washer-dryer.
"What do you think? Turning on our coffee maker from 1975 fried it?"
The crewman laughed politely. Dad opened the panel, flipped the breaker, and the lights came back on. Marjorie must have been up at the top of the stairs, pressed right up against the bulkhead doors, because I still couldn't see her. She wasn't coming down. Dad said,
"Come on, Mary. You've got your snack. I don't want you playing down here."
"Okay."
Dad put a hand on my back and gently nudged me. His hand was warm and a little sweaty. He and the crewman followed me back up to the first floor. They shut the basement door. I scurried under the dining room table and watched the door. I thought about opening the door for Marjorie, not that it was locked or she needed it opened for her. It just felt like something I should do, but I didn't. When I was munching on my last peanut butter cracker, I heard our front door open slowly, even with all of the commotion and conversations around me. I heard the whisper of the outside coming in, and I heard her quiet but hurried footsteps pattering up the stairs in the front foyer, and again, it sounded like she had more than 2 feet. Later, when the crew was done with setup, Barry, the director, and Dad took me upstairs and told me that the sunroom was now the confessional room. We would and could go in there by ourselves and talk to the camera about what had happened, or talk about anything that was on our minds. For my first confessional, I went in with the intention of saying only, "I want my sunroom back." And then I would fold my arms obstinately and glare at the camera, or maybe I'd scuttle behind the camera and actually tear down the terrible black cloth covering the bay window and explain myself by saying the room couldn't breathe with the window being covered and it could die. Instead, when I went in there and pressed the record button like they'd shown me, I thought about Marjorie in the basement and how she had lied about faking everything and saving the house. I could pretend. I could fake it. I could lie and help save the house, too. So I did. I told the camera a story about Marjorie sneaking up on me in the basement, her saying weird stuff to me like she had before, her eyes being all white, her eating dirt, making her tongue into a black worm, and how she made the lights go out. I told the cameras that Marjorie was being really scary, and that something evil was now living inside her.
Chapter 17. We'd been living with the crew for 2 weeks. It was a Sunday morning, the same day of the show's premiere. Dad woke me up and tried to make me go to church. There were no mounted cameras in any of our bedrooms, so he brought Jen, the camera woman, up with him, which totally backfired. I'm sure he was thinking that, as the good daughter, I wouldn't be able to say no to church with Jen and her camera watching. I knew that not only could I say no, but that he couldn't get mad and start yelling at me. So I said no, and I told him that church was creepy. I smiled lazily, reached out to hug him around the neck when I said it, and I meant the creepy part as our little joke. When I was in kindergarten, I'd gone through a phase where I'd described everything I didn't like as creepy. Mom had been annoyed by it, but Dad had loved it and had quizzed me on what was or wasn't creepy. Milk, mud, and airplanes were good. Pickles, shoelaces, and purple were creepy. Dad didn't think my "church is creepy" joke was funny, though. He dodged my hug, let out a sigh, and said,
"You shouldn't say that, Mary. It isn't right."
He did an awkward little dance trying to get around Jen and then stormed off down the hallway. Jen followed. I felt bad enough that I tiptoed to the sunroom, peeled back a corner of the drop cloth, and watched him and Jen drive off to church. When I got downstairs, Mom was at the table with the writer, Ken Fletcher, and Tony, the cameraman. Ken had a little black notebook on the table in front of him, and he jotted down some notes. He was my parents' age, but he looked younger. He wore black Chuck Taylor sneakers, jeans, and dark logoless t-shirts. He would talk with me whenever he could, and he actually listened to what I had to say. Not like when other crew members would ask how I was doing. They were only asking to be polite, asking for the sake of asking. Tony, the cameraman, had oversized earphones looped around his giraffe neck. I didn't like Tony. He wasn't friendly. His beard was too curly and his fingernails were too long and clicky. He was creepy. The three of them were eating breakfast sandwiches. Mom had saved one for me. I quickly pulled mine apart and ate just the cheese and egg part. I told Mom that I had a lot of energy, and she had to help me get rid of it with a timed obstacle course. Ken laughed, closed his notebook, and wrapped it with a red rubber band. Tony left the kitchen with his camera perched on his shoulder, announcing he was taking a break. Mom said, "Really, Mary, but you just ate?" I grabbed Mom's arm and pulled her down, her face almost touching mine. "Yes." "Mary, stop it. Okay." Mom turned to Ken and said, "We do this sometimes. She has lots of energy." Ken laughed. It was a loud and bright sound. He said, "I love it." Mom said, "Okay, listen carefully. Run out to the living room, sit on the couch, then go into the dining room, do 2 laps around the table, then upstairs to your bedroom, lie down, feet all the way off the floor, then come back down and shake Ken's hand." I was so pleased that I had to shake hands with Ken. I wanted to show off for him. Mom knew this and indulged. I said, "Got it. Where's your phone? You have to time me on your phone." I jumped up and down and tugged on Mom's shirt sleeve. "Relax, I'll just count." Ken said,
"My watch has a second hand. I'll time you. Ready?"
"Wait a minute!"
I yelled in a Muppet voice and scrambled out of my chair and into imaginary starter blocks.
"Okay."
"Ready, set."
Ken paused long enough for me to turn, look at him, and give him a scary monster face.
"Go."
I sprinted around the house, following Mom's instructions to the letter. Racing to the finish, I plowed into the kitchen like a wrecking ball, slamming into Ken. I tried to shake his hand to end it, but he kept moving it away. I yelled, "Hey!" with mock outrage, then latched onto his arm, held it still, and finally was able to grab his hand. Mom said,
"Yeah, she's shy." "Clearly. And strong. Wow."
Ken let his arm hang like it was dead.
"What was my time? What was my time?"
52 seconds.
"I can beat that."
I ran the course 2 more times, with my personal best being 46 seconds. After the 3rd run, I told Ken that he should write my obstacle course into the show. Mom's and Ken's smiles dimmed a bit at that, and they both took synchronized sips of their coffees. Mom said, "Why don't you go outside and burn off the rest of your energy? You probably shouldn't be sprinting around the house with all the expensive equipment we have in here now."
"No."
I tried not to sound whiny, but there were way too many O's in my no. Ken said,
"I'll go outside with you. Can we kick the soccer ball around?"
"Yeah, okay."
Mom said, "Ken, you don't have to."
"No, it's okay. I want to get outside. Nice, crisp fall day. And I want to see what kind of soccer player Mary is. I've heard she's real good."
I sprinted out of the kitchen to get a sweatshirt, afraid Mom would change his mind somehow. I heard her say, "She's relentless." Leaves covered the backyard, and the wind had blown a pile into my small, rickety soccer net. Thin white PVC pipes struggled to hold its barely upright shape. The crossbar sagged in the middle. Ken wasn't outside yet, so I cleared the goal of as many leaves as I could and pushed the rest through the square holes in the netting. The leaves were wet, and I wiped my hands on my jeans and inspected them for ticks, even though it was too cold for ticks. I marched around crunching leaves and keeping the soccer ball between my feet while waiting for Ken to come out. I had a white fleece sweatshirt on with multicolored peace symbols all over it. It was tight and too small, but it was my favorite. Ken walked out of the back door wearing a thick brown and green sweater and a scarf. He bounded down the small back porch, rubbed his hands together, and said,
"Brr, it's colder than I thought. We'll be warm after I score a bunch of goals on you, though."
I said, "Bring it on, old man." We jumped right into a game of one-on-one. It was slow going with all the leaves in the way. It was tough to get solid footing. Ken took it easy on me initially, which made me play harder. I did get the sense Ken used to be very good, but his feet were heavier now and weren't keeping up with the rest of him. He fell a few times, and he stepped on my foot once. I didn't let on how much it hurt. As the game went on, he got winded, and I had the advantage of knowing how to use the slight downward pitch of the backyard. I won the slightly rigged game 5-4 with a goal that almost knocked the net down. The ball skimmed off the crossbar and wrapped around the left post. After the game, we passed the ball back and forth. Ken was down toward the bottom of our yard. I was at the top.
"You're a very good player, Mary. I'm impressed."
I said,
"Thanks. Your cheeks look like big red apples."
Ken kicked me the ball and then bent over, putting his hands on his knees, breathing heavily.
"Well, you kicked my butt, Mary. Your cheeks look like little crab apples."
"Crab apples? What are those?"
I laughed. I imagined apples with pincer claws and how difficult it would be to pick them off a tree and bake them in a pie.
"They're little and more purple than red. Can't really eat them. Believe me, I've tried. We had a crabapple tree in my front yard when I was a kid."
The lazy passing morphed into a playful competition. Our passes became crisper. We both switched legs and stopping techniques. Ken let the ball roll up his foot and into the air, then kicked it with his other foot. I tried to do the same, but the ball rolled up my leg and hit me in the chin.
"Ow!"
"You okay?"
"Yeah."
I asked,
"Did you know that I have to ask permission to go into the confessional room now?"
"Yes, I heard that."
"It's not fair, because everyone else in my family can go in whenever they want."
"Well, you have been going in there a lot, and there's only so much we can show in an hour of TV, which is more like 42 minutes with all the commercials, and more like 32 minutes with the post-commercial scene resets. Whoa!"
I kicked the ball extra hard and a little wide of him. The ball went crashing into the line of tall bushes at the end of our property. I said,
"I like to talk. I can't help it."
Ken had to go in deep to pluck the ball out of the bushes. He walked back up the hill to me with the ball cradled in his right arm. He said,
"That's it. I'm cooked, and I have to do some work."
I wanted to shout, "No, stay out here with me." But I fought the urge. Instead, my whole body slumped and went slack. Ken said,
"Come on. I have a great idea. Follow me out front."
I grabbed the soccer ball, quickly scrambled up the porch to the back door, tossed the ball into the catch-all shoe bin in the mudroom, then ran back to Ken. I walked with him around the house, let him lead, even though he was taking us the hardest way to go. His scarf got caught as we weaved through and dodged low.